WGM. Elise Glink joins us on most Mondays at this time. She's with Think Link Media and Best Money Moves. Did you anticipate the progress that the administration evidently made with China over the weekend?
Well, I think we got a little bit of a sense that this was coming, but I think the news is better than almost anybody thought. I mean, the idea that you're having the 90-day pause was really good, and the numbers that they're now talking about for a tariff are much lower with China than what was originally planned. And so the 10% duties will stay in effect, but all the reciprocal tariffs, you know, the ones that are like 145%, those are all going to be put on hold. And I think the market is reacting to that in an extremely positive way. We see, as you just heard in the news, numbers way over the board, all up, all green, solidly very positive.
I wonder what then still needs to be determined. Will there be carve-outs? What about contracts that have been written? I wonder if this is a pause for negotiation, or is this actually where it's going to settle, you know?
I hope this is where it's going to settle, but I'm pretty sure we're going to find out that it's not, right? I think that the one thing we've learned over the last 4 months with this administration is there's a lot of up and down, right? And a lot of uncertainty. And I don't think that what we've done is we've not settled anything. What we've done is paused it while the talks are ongoing for 90 days. So if you mean that it's settled for 90 days, I do think that we're going to see some stability, which would be good. But the concern again is, you know, what do you do about this slowdown in orders? It takes so long. And I think we talked about this a little bit last week. And I know I talked about it with Lisa Dent on Friday. You know, you can't just place an order with China and then have it show up in your doorstep the next day. And so on Friday, the numbers were released from one of the early surveys that showed that across the board at ports throughout the United States, you have in almost every port a reduction of the numbers of containers that are coming in. And some, I think it's, I'm not looking at the number exactly, John, but I think it was like Portland, it was down 50%. From the number of containers. And the containers that are starting to be delivered are containers for summer into fall. And then beyond that, the next round is going to be Christmas. And we're going to see Christmas stuff start to arrive on our shores, you know, a few months ahead of time, right? It has to go from the port and get distributed. And then from there to the individual stores or stocking. And, you know, it doesn't just happen overnight. And so seeing this hold for 90 days will allow some companies to feel a little bit better about stocking up for Christmas. But what's going to happen in 6 to 8 weeks or 10 weeks when those containers start to arrive? Will they get the 10% or will it be back up to 145? And when is that tariff actually owed and paid? And so I think there's some questions still to answer, even with the pause as the ongoing negotiations are going, you know, continuing.
Well, if this was the strategy all along, ask for a ridiculously high tariff, know that they might retaliate, then each of you has sort of called each other's bluff, and then without anybody saying you blinked, we'll go behind closed doors, we'll come out, we'll say, okay, we've agreed to these terms. But then it makes one wonder, what was the point of all of that, if that was the idea all along? I guess we could not have anticipated how resolute China was going to be. Maybe China thought Donald Trump is stubborn enough that he'll ride 145% and crash the world's economy if that's the way you all want to play. I just wonder, though, if the two of them sort of figured that this was where we were going to be, why did we have to go through this whole song and dance to begin with? Because at least for, say, this Christmas or for those orders you're talking about, some people will have lost money. Maybe they will have lost their businesses. I wonder now, how many dolls do the kids get now? Are we back up to 30, maybe 15? You know, if you're going to use that analogy, yeah. What is the real world fallout for people as a result of this negotiation tactic? That's what I'm wondering.
No, I think that's an excellent point. You know, people just don't understand how things big and small come from China, right? I have a friend in L.A., and she makes kind of customized trading card decks. They're wonderful. And one of them that she has coming out now is a tarot deck with cats on it. It's adorable. If you love cats, you'll love her tarot deck. But she, you know, called me up about 6 weeks ago and said, I don't know what to do. Should I order? How much am I going to be able to charge for these? Like, she had already set her pricing and her marketing, and suddenly there was this big thing. So you have something as small as that. You had a story in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend about small businesses going out of business and firing people because they just don't know what to do and if they can even get it. And then here we are on the other side looking at, you know, Christmas with really big companies. And I think what you're going to start to see is companies not making things in the United States. We're too expensive here to make things like socks, right? But they are going to start to diversify the supplier chain, and you'll see more being made in maybe Vietnam.
You're making me wonder, at least we'll pause here, but I mean, so maybe we resolve that we'll charge you 30%, you'll charge us 10%. But I thought that the purpose of this was, A, to punish China, to get them to play more fairly. But I also thought the purpose was to onshore business in America, to build up manufacturing. Well, if the tariffs are that modest, I don't know that it's going to accomplish that. You know, it's so funny to take this good news and turn it upside down and look for the bad part of it. Maybe we all ought to just pause and say, whew, okay, this is good news. As one post said that I saw this morning, thank God the adults are back in the room. And it does seem to be as though saner, sober heads have actually gotten a handle on this sort of thing and are steering the ship. So let's appreciate that for a minute here. We're talking with Elise Glink from Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. You'll find her stuff at thinkglink.com. You ready to move on to the car loans today?
Sure.
What's the news there on car loans?
Well, you know, car loans have become increasingly difficult to get, and that's because companies, car dealerships, and other companies that finance these loans are starting to see the default rates rise. And that's a problem because, you know, we've got the student loans that are now going into collections for the first time since 2020, March of 2020. Everything was put on pause there, but now those loans are going into collections. It's going to start to hit people's credit scores, and it's going to make it even more difficult to get a car loan for a lot of people. So we're seeing lenders like Wells Fargo and Capital One tightening their standards. More people are getting rejected, or they're getting charged a higher interest rate. So, for example, Ally Financial received a 3.8 million loan applications in the first quarter of 2025, but it approved fewer borrowers than the prior quarter. And then prices are going up, right? We've got we talk a lot, you and I, about what interest rates are for mortgages. Well, for cars, they tend to be higher. So if you've got a super prime, meaning you're a credit score of 781 to 850, you know, you can get a 4.77 or 4.8% APR for a new car and a little over 7.5% for a used car. But if you're, you know, you go down the chain, you might be paying 9, 10, 15, or even almost 20% for a used car, or 13% for a new car. And that's for people with what they call subprime credit scores, mm-hmm. 501 to 600. So there's just a wide range of pricing that's going on, but people's credit scores are starting to take a hit and more of them are going to fall for that. But even beyond credit scores, it's everybody just wants the very best, you know, credit scores, the very best credit histories. They want to make sure that they're getting people who are going to pay those loans off.
Let's just walk through those numbers again. You said subprime 780 to 850 for a new car, 4.7%. If you're prime, 661 to 780, your credit score, rather than 477, you pay 6.4. If you're between 601 and 660, your new car rate is over 9.5%. Subprime, 13.08%. So this best credit score, you can buy a new car for under 5. And if you have the worst credit score, you pay over 13. What a difference. And it's just, I understand why it's that way, but I can't help but state the obvious irony that the people that have the lowest credit scores, might have the lowest income or the most bills, the less available cash, and therefore we're going to charge them the most for the loan, which means it's most likely they'll default on the loan because they're paying so much for the money. So if we were really going to, you see how this is a vicious circle, don't you?
Oh, yes. So it's interesting, John, because there's an even lower group with an even higher interest rate than this. So if you don't even qualify, let's say you've got a no-file credit score or a thin file, that means you don't even have enough stuff attached to your Social Security number for a credit company like Equifax, TransUnion, or Experian, or FICO to score you. Then you end up buying a car from a car company where you literally have to pay them as much as 25 to 30% interest on a car that's typically terrible, like not in great shape, right, definitely used, and on its last legs anyway, which for a lot of people, when they drive off the lot, the wheel sort of falls off, literally and figuratively, and they end up in much worse trouble. So to your point, yes, the people who can least afford it end up paying the most. But overall, you know, people are still paying a lot more for these cars. Now, sometimes new car dealers, even today, will offer very few times, but 0% financing or 2% or 3% financing. So you should definitely check around and see what you qualify for and where your best deal is going to be if you have to buy a car. Because remember, new cars today are already at the highest average cost in history. About $46,000 is the average price for a new car these days.
Elise Glink's the owner of Think Glink Media, Best Money Moves. You'll find her stuff at thinkglink.com. Okay, let's visit again next Monday. Thank you, Elise.
Always a pleasure, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Most Mondays, we get to talk to Jim Dahlke, the Director of Communications at Tech Nexus Venture Collaborative. Hey, Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, with the news today about a maybe possible trade deal with China, at least a 90-day pause, and the trade deal just may be modest tariffs and no more. But I think a lot of people are then thinking about, okay, what does this mean to supply chains? What does this mean to the price of goods and services? Cars are always a big player in this thing. And you guys have a story about Rivian. Talk to me a little bit about what J.B. Pritzker and Rivian are doing in Illinois.
Yeah, that's right. So Rivian, is in the news recently this month. They are expanding their presence down in downstate Normal, Illinois. So Rivian, of course, is the Tesla competitor. It's got trucks and SUVs that are completely electric. And they have announced they've committed $120 million in investment in a brand new supplier park that's going to be built in 2026 down there in Normal, Illinois. This is going to create about 100 new jobs for Rivian there. As it brings a new supplier park to its ecosystem of electric vehicle maintenance and construction down there. So this is, you know, a business that's headquartered in California, but really its manufacturing is done right here in Illinois, and is definitely one of the more interesting kind of EV projects to watch throughout the state here. And what we're going to see here is really the ability to get closer to their suppliers. So they're going to create this facility directly for suppliers who are creating parts for Rivian. And the interesting thing about this is that to kind of increase the efficiency, they've got an underground tunnel that connects the supplier park to their main manufacturing. And so you can get parts back and forth super efficiently. So really interesting news here, local to Illinois here from a main EV player in Rivian.
Where does that tunnel go? From where to where?
Yeah, so basically where the supplier headquarters is. So it's going to be a place where a bunch of Rivian suppliers are going to be making parts for the Rivian truck and the Rivian SUV, and it's going to connect directly to their main manufacturing facility. And so it's just all about kind of making part transfer more efficient and getting those parts from one building to another.
I presume that's not going to be a very long tunnel, right? It's not going to California. No,
it's really, right here in Normal, right? So, so it's just really about kind of from one building to another, kind of getting those parts over very super quickly.
Wow.
So we're in town still, but a nice, interesting little piece of innovation there rather than, kind of running parts, to the other side of the complex or the campus, kind of going underground.
Wow. You'd think that you could put it on a truck or however you get something from A to B. You could just get it from one part of the campus to another or from maybe this office to that office over there, that plant. They're going to specially build, dig a tunnel just so they can save the amount of time it would take to get them from A to B.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, Rivian is you know, really bullish and on Normal, Illinois specifically, too, which I find so interesting, is that, you know, this business really could have kind of chosen to build its manufacturing really anywhere. Obviously, Rivian's not headquartered in Illinois, but, you know, this is where those vehicles are made. And so, they really see value and kind of building within, Illinois and Normal, Illinois specifically, and did get about $16 million in tax credits to continue to build out this next part of their facility down there.
Isn't that the old Mitsubishi plant? And then Rivian acquired that, which might have made it more attractive to them. And do you know, are those UAW workers? Is that a union shop where they're making these cars? They must be, right?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure on the UAW piece, but it definitely is an old Mitsubishi plant. So yeah, that is kind of, you know, how they sort of revitalized that plant specifically. And, you know, obviously great to see, that space take on a new life now. And as we head to the future of EVs, I mean, I think that, you know, electric vehicles is one of those things that we've kind of been talking about in the industry for a long time. We at TechNexus Venture Collaborative, you know, we've invested in several electrification startups, you know, really bullish on the future of EVs. It's really not a matter of if, but when. And so, you know, Rivian is certainly a major player in that, you know, competing head-to-head with the likes of Teslas and others. And we're doing a lot of that production and manufacturing right here in Illinois.
Talk to me about Chicago's life sciences market.
Yeah, so a new report from Colliers shows kind of where Chicago stacks up compared to some other cities when it comes to life sciences, momentum, growth, innovation. Chicago ranks ninth in the country. As the city decides of Chicago, right, you would hope that maybe we're up a little higher on that list. But, it shows that there's some progress here. Chicago has, seen some nice marks here in terms of venture capital and some growth from groups like Portal Innovation. We talked about the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub initiative that's helped grow life sciences momentum and innovation here in Chicago. Other cities that are certainly a little bit smaller than Chicago have been outpacing it, cities like San Diego, Raleigh, Seattle. And so there's a little bit of ways to go, but certainly some promising notes here. And there's definitely some momentum for Chicago in terms of continuing to grow as a biotech hub. A couple of tech companies that are doing really well, of course, one is Tempus, which went public last year. Its stock is up over 50%. In the last 12 months, this is a business from Eric Lukofsky, the former Groupon founder. They have a spinoff called Pathos AI, which has helped creating new drugs, and it's raising up to $400 million in new funding. So there's certainly capital being pumped into local biotech and, kind of biotech/AI adjacent businesses. And we'll have to keep an eye on it, but certainly some room to grow for Chicago's life sciences scene overall.
Would you say that Pulse Charter Connect is one of those allied businesses?
Yeah, it's certainly a connected business for sure, or tangential. So Pulse Charter Connect is a really interesting Chicago startup. They are effectively the Expedia for organ transplant. They just raised another $2 million in funding to grow their business, which is all about more effectively and efficiently transporting organs across the country. And so they are able to tap into the charter jet network to get organs across the country and get really kind of past those bottlenecks and get more people the organ transplants they need to save their life. And this is a business that's done about 65 organ transplants already, and they expect to hit about 175 this year. So a really interesting Chicago startup, and now another $2 million in the bank from venture funding as it looks to grow.
They're not the physicians. They're simply the So in other words, the hospitals, say one place and another, would contract with them to be ready to move quickly, huh?
Totally. So they do all the coordination, all the communication, and figure out the logistics as well. So, yeah, basically they're getting these organ transplants right on the first-class private jet saving time, and by doing so, lowering coordination costs and saving costs in the story as well. So, what they're able to do is kind of really get, free up that bottleneck and get folks who are on those long waiting lists off the waiting list.
Seems like we've talked about this before. They did win one of those sort of Shark Tank style competitions, right?
Yeah, that's right. So earlier this year, they won the top prize, the Tech Rise Chicago Pitch competition. So that got them $100,000 in non-dilutive prize money. That's a really, you know, great pitch competition here in Chicago, a way to get, you know, six figures of funding without giving up any equity in your startup. And so, you know, this organ transplant logistics startup is definitely making moves, and it's definitely a startup to watch here in Chicago.
Nice to talk to you, Jim Dahlke, the Director of Communications at Tech Nexus Venture Collaborative. We'll talk next week, Jim.
Thanks, John.
More business on the Wintrust, more business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Arlington Heights North Point Center has been acquired by a Texas investor. According to Crane's Encore Enterprises, acquired a majority stake in the shopping center for $34 million. It's located at the intersection of Rand Road and Arlington Heights Road. AMCAP affiliates previously had a majority stake and will maintain a minority share. Encore has assumed AMCAP's mortgage. Encore has 26 properties in the U.S. and specializes in buying, developing, and managing retail centers. The Chicago-based American Medical Association has a new CEO and executive vice president. He's Dr. John White. He'll take over at AMA following a stint as chief medical officer at WebMD. White has been a practicing physician for nearly 30 years. He previously served for the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the Department of Health and Human Services, and Food and Drug Administration. As AMA CEO, he'll deal with the group's top priority, fixing Medicare, as doctors see a fifth straight year of reimbursement cuts under Medicare. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And let's jump in the time machine and go back to the golden age of French fries.
You really have to include McDonald's in this story.
Yes, because if you were born before, oh, let's say 1985, then you were around when McDonald's fries were the gold standard. So good that some would say they were addictive. But then, in the summer of 1990,
McDonald's got peer pressured into switching their beef tallow to a vegetable oil.
And that, many would argue, was the end of McDonald's having the best fries in the land.
And at the time, the thought was that saturated fats were very bad for you and that trans fats were better. We know now that trans fats are way worse for you.
So now, beef tallow is making a comeback. More about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. Our beef tallow expert today is Joe Fontana, the founder and owner of a Chicago-area chicken sandwich chain called Fry the Coop. And kudos, Joe, to whoever came up with that name.
My wife did, actually.
Yeah, that was several years ago when Joe had one of those cubicle jobs.
And just couldn't stand being in a cubicle.
So, with no experience whatsoever, he decided to try the chicken sandwich business.
We opened up with no sign, no customers either. Just started, you know, selling one chicken sandwich at a time.
And one became 10 and 10 became 20. And
fast forward 7.5 years later, we're about to open our 10th location.
And he says the keys to success include fresh, never frozen chicken breasts.
We just make this handmade product with love, and it's made to order and kind of like a craft fried chicken sandwich.
And
we also fry everything in beef tallow,
which may make it taste great, but 9 out of 10 doctors are not recommending it.
Yeah, and let's be honest, you know, it's fried food, so it's not healthy to begin with. But if you're going to eat French fries, which we all do, you'd rather be fried in something, you know, natural.
Fry the Coop, now with 10 stores in the Chicago area.
Our audacious goal now is to open up 75 stores.
You can see the whole story at frythecoop.com. On the food calendar, it's National Nutty Fudge Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Brandon Copeland's back, the co-founder and CEO at athletes.org. The topic is NIL now. Brandon, how are you? You're on WGN.
I'm doing phenomenal. Appreciate you having me. How you doing?
Good. You were 10 years in the NFL, right?
Yeah, 10 years. 10 years. Who would ever thought? Undrafted free agent. But, fortunately, was able to make it 10 years and had a lot of good battles against the Bears, you know, believe it or not. So,
refresh my memory. Who did you play for?
6 different teams in 10 years. So the Baltimore Ravens came to the Tennessee Titans after that, and then the Detroit Lions for 3 years, which is where we had a lot of those battles. The New York Jets for 2 years, New England Patriots 4 years, the Atlanta Falcons 4 years, and then finished up with the Baltimore Ravens. So a little trip around at least the east side of the country, middle to the east side of the country.
You're a Wharton School of Finance grad. Did that come before or after your NFL career?
Before. That was before.
So you had a Wharton degree and you played in the NFL.
Yeah. Yeah, it was something that I had the opportunity to do coming out of high school. My grandfather played for 11 years in the NFL himself. And when we had Ivy League schools looking to recruit us, the third to last game of my high school season, my senior year, I had a teammate of mine fall on the back of my ankle doing kick return. And the only reason I was on kick return, that was my first time doing that since seventh grade. And my own teammate fell on the back of my ankle and it popped. And I finished the rest of the season, but I was limping and I wasn't the same. But that was the example, the real life example for me of when all the adults and parents and role models in your life say, hey, you're always one play away from this thing being taken from you forever. To experience that and have that college decision looming for me, it made it clear that I should go with Penn and Wharton School of Business, because that's something that would last with me forever, regardless of how football turned out. So fortunately, it worked out for me a bit.
Yeah, you still got the money and then maybe had the financial wherewithal or background to better manage it, which is a real problem for athletes, isn't it?
It is. It is. I'd say, you know, I always tell people I think it's a problem for society, frankly. I mean, we have a I heard you guys talking about the market, and you know, we see it ripping back today and things of that nature in a good way. But you know, our government can't balance a checkbook. The average human being can't balance a checkbook. And for athletes, we get inundated not only with a lot of money fast without any formal education around it, which a lot of people put on the NFL. But I think that, again, my mom should learn about investments and 401ks and things like that in high school, which is why we created a class on these things. And so athletes, they not only get the money, but then you also share what their salary is publicly, and you put a target on their backs.
That's a good way to put it. Brandon Copeland's on the line, athletes.org. What's happening with NIL right now then with these guys?
Yeah, so right now NIL, which stands for name, image, and likeness, for those who don't understand or aren't familiar, I should say, is a ruling that became enabled and enacted on July 1st, 2021, that allowed for college athletes to finally make money off of their name, image, or their likeness. Which what that means is, before that time, an athlete could not make money for doing autographs or for showing up and getting paid for an appearance. And a lot of athletes have gotten in trouble as a result of that. Now the NCAA has allowed for it to happen, and it's continued to evolve to this point where right now the NCAA has kind of pulled themselves out of the place of enforcement or enforcer, because they've continued to get sued. And now you have the largest case in really, you know, college athletics history in the House versus NCAA case that is currently being considered for settlement right now. And ultimately, that case will pay back $2.8 billion in damages to previous athletes. And then going forward, it will finally allow for schools to pay athletes directly. And I guess my quick take on it is, NIL is great. NIL is phenomenal. You should always be able to make money off of your name, your image, and your likeness. And that should have never been prohibited in the first place. And I know some people may not understand why. We could have a longer discussion on that. But ultimately, right now, why it's in flux is because athletes are being promised money based off of their NIL, their name, image, and likeness value, but they're really being promised this money to come play tight end or come play quarterback or come play running back at their school. And the difference with NIL versus pay for play is the difference between how pro athletes are compensated. They're compensated for throwing touchdowns and for catching the ball, but that money comes from their ticket sales and their concessions and jersey sales and things of that nature. The money that the school or the team generates off of putting on a electrifying sport. Right now, NIL has been used to get donors and fans to put money into these things called collectives to now pay athletes to come play running back. And that's where there's been a lot of issues and false promises and things of that nature.
I'll talk with you about that another day. But then, to be clear, are there two pools of money, the money the school can give the athlete and then the collective's NIL pool of money? Is that the way it's working out or going to work out?
That's the way it will work out, is you'll have a cap, like a salary cap that works with the NFL or NBA, but that'll be what the school can pay to its athletes. And then a lot of schools will continue to have their collective operate tangentially from the school to go pay additional money to athletes. And again, frankly, that'll be one of the next problems. You know, there's a true NIL, it's true marketing, but if the Patriots or the Falcons can pay their quarterback not only within the salary cap, but then also have a whole separate vehicle to pay people more money to come to their team, again, the balance of parity in the sport will never have a chance to, quote unquote, exist, which I think that's why you see a lot of the objections and things of that nature that you'll see in the future, you know?
I think you put it well. Brandon Copeland, co-founder and CEO at athletes.org, with a look at where NIL is and where it's going. And you and I need to talk about this more down the road, Brandon. Thanks for your insight today.
I'd love to. Thank you. I would love to. Have a great one.